Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this weekend's edition, we're going to be focusing on the resource sector, talking more some individual companies, some investment strategies around investing in resource equities, as well as more big picture views on what's driving some of the moves in the precious metals, as well as some of the base metals, maybe some other metals that we'll get to as well. We're kicking off the show with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe, you've been joining us on a monthly basis to share your thoughts on what's going on within the resource sector. And what I want to start off with today is the investment landscape, or at least your investment narrative, when we look at exploration companies that have investments or some sort of partnership with major mining companies. Now, I'll first break it down into two different factors here. Major companies can invest in the equity of the underlying exploration company, so they get exposure to all of the projects, or they can choose specific projects and have individual earn-in options on one or a basket of these projects, all with different stages of earning in. Let's start here, Joe. How, when you're an investor, do you look at these two different type of relationships between majors and exploration companies?
All right. Thanks for the question, Corey. I could probably give it to you from both two perspectives, actually, or three. I can give it to you from the retail investor, so what I would look at it as an investor in that junior. I can also tell you what it's like for the junior, because I spend a lot of time with these CEOs, but I also could tell you from the perspective of the major, because I used to do that as well when I worked in corporate development for Newmont. So if we start with the major, you know, if they like a project, they usually like to do a footprint into the company, you know, up to a 19.9% stake. And this is, you know, not unlike marking your territory for, apex predator. And that way telling the other ones that this one's mine. To do it at the project level means less liability for the company, because then they're just earning into the project and they don't have to do a lot of due diligence on the company. Like, does the company have other liabilities? Does the company's management team have any pending lawsuits or anything like that? What you would want with respect to a clean structure is just take equity in the project and not buy shares of the company. So that way you don't have to buy the company, you get the project, and eventually potentially dilute the company out and leave them with an NSR. That would be a clean way of taking the project out, because you're probably not interested in taking out the entire company. From a small company perspective, depending on the company, like with Hercules Silver, when they hit that intersection at their project in Idaho that I visited last year, they did not want, their management team did not want a project earn-in. They would rather the equity, because I think from their perspective, the equity can come and go, but it doesn't, there's less risk of another player coming in and bidding them up. Whereas if the major gets an interest in the project, it's harder to find somebody else to come in. And from the perspective of the investor, it's always nice to see a major come in to put a bit of a stamp of approval on the project and or the management team. With respect to exploration, like we were talking about, you know, the multi-year program earn-ins that companies like Headwater and Inflection are doing. What is nice about those is that you can think about the long term, because exploration, grassroots especially, exploration is about the long term. You know, 3 to 5 year funded program that doesn't need a lot of money, but it needs consistent funding. That way you're not always trying to drill the next intersection because you know you have to go back to the market in March. This way, you know you'll have funding. And at the beginning of the year, you're always looking at, okay, what's this next year's program going to look like? And then say, this would be what I'd like to do, but this is might be what I can only do because the market is a lot worse this year. Whereas for somebody like, let's say, Inflection or Headwater, they're more guaranteed of their programs for the next year. And that's basically what grassroots explorers need. So I hope that handles all three perspectives.
Thanks for breaking that down, Joe. And just a follow-up on that, as far as retail investors listening to this call or looking at companies that have that strategic partner coming in at an equity level or a project level, yes, it does give them the vetting and it is good to see. But some people have made the point that you really want to see companies that have maybe a couple of these in there at 10% or less. So maybe a 10%, a 7%, a 5%, as opposed to just the 19.9%, because it limits the amount of suitors that could actually take over the project down the road. What is your thought on that debate of having multiples in at smaller levels versus one larger one at 19 or even at 50%?
Yeah, no, I think, if you could do that, there's very few companies that are able to do that. I mean, Orion have that. They have, a few majors with equity positions in them. I mean, Origin has Altius that has an equity position in them. They don't have another a major royalty company with an equity position in them. But yeah, I would guess, like, if you want the potential for a multiple bid, you would want multiple players that have interest. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily need two or three with less than 10%. But if you have one less than 10%, it's sort of saying to the other one that they could come in and they could still acquire the company and bid the other one out. But somebody with 19.9%, it's harder to do.
So, Joe, what are these majors looking for when they do enter these sort of partnerships, especially on a project-specific aspect? Because, as you said, they can have multiple drill programs here. So it's not so dependent on, let's say, the first drill results. But as, let's say, if you're an investor in these exploration companies, what do you need to see in terms of exploration progress to have confidence that that major isn't going to exit that relationship?
Yeah, you can have something that's more project specific that, okay, here's the project and we're earning into it and we're going to be drilling it and it's got to meet this criteria. So with B2 Gold going into Snowline, it's definitely the Valley prospect that they're looking at, drilling that, infilling that, looking at, infrastructure, looking at all that sort of stuff, very specific to that project. Whereas AngloGold Ashanti with Inflection, that's more grassroots exploration. So what they're doing and spending money on Inflection is basically stuff that they're not doing. So they don't have an exploration team that's doing what Inflection is doing. Inflection came up with the idea. They have the people that understand what they're doing. And basically AngloGold Ashanti is supporting them with even more geophysical data than Inflection would have thought that they would get access to, more geophysical interpretation than they would normally have been able to do. And so the goal of AngloGold Ashanti basically is to find another Cadia, which is obviously a tier one copper gold asset that, one of the assets that Newmont bought Newcrest for. But that same host rock called the Macquarie Arc that trends to the north in New South Wales goes under soft cover. And that's where Inflection is. They know the Macquarie Arc keeps going. They've drilled it. Now they have to look for the same types of deposits under cover. That requires a multi-year commitment. And AngloGold Ashanti is very willing to do that because the prize is very significant. If we look at Headwater, the initial agreement was signed by Newcrest. And their idea was to look for not Carlin type, but low sulfidation epithermal types of deposits that were underground, 1.5 to 2 million ounces of high grade. But what's happened since is Newmont has taken over Newcrest, and they have a bigger hurdle with respect to how big the deposit's got to be now, because now it's a much bigger company. But also, AngloGold Ashanti in the background has found the Silicon Merlin deposit, which is about 14 million ounces in all categories in Nevada. in the Walker Lane Belt. So now that's a different model, looking at the same ground where Headwater already is. So to be able to find something like that is what would interest Newmont, and potentially same sort of deposit style, but you know, now you're getting into that deposit style could be something that might be tier one for a Newmont.
Well, Joe, just in thinking about this, as far as strategic companies coming in, the larger companies and partnering with the smaller exploration companies, there's a point where you brought up earlier Orion Resources having multiple partners. You know, if we look at the Finland area right now, it's actually pretty exciting with a bunch of companies jostling for position. You've got Agnico Eagle that has an operating mine there that has positioned in Rupert. They also just took a big stake out in Firefox, which to your point earlier is kind of like saying, hey, this is the area we're interested in. You've got Kinross inside of Orion, but you also have the JV partnership they had with B2 Gold. And now that JV partnership, the 70% that belonged to B2 Gold, Rupert wants to buy it, but Orion has this right of first refusal to bring in somebody else. When you see a bunch of majors in an area, kind of an area play, does that give you more confidence as an investor that, hey, this is something that obviously multiple big boys are interested in?
Absolutely. So Finland infrastructurally is excellent. The types of deposits they can discover, develop, and put into production are much more profitable despite the latitude because of the infrastructure advantages. Kittila, which is Agnico's mine, would not be built if it was in Canada. It's 4, maybe 5 gram underground, refractory. There's no way you would build that project in Canada. You know, you would be dealing with diesel power and, you know, infrastructure issues, ice roads and all that other stuff, camps. Whereas these people drive to work every day. They have grid power, which is mostly hydro that comes right to site. And, you know, it's open all year round. There's no, port facility that's required to bring in all the equipment. So Finland is excellent with respect to infrastructure. But then you add a high-grade open pit deposit, which is what Ikkari is. So you've got a potential major deposit here in a great jurisdiction, all the infrastructure you could want. But the problem is the land position requires a layback that would make that mine much more profitable than the scoping study suggests. The pre-feasibility study that Rupert was planning on doing in the first quarter has been pushed back. Why? Because I don't think anybody who wants to take over Rupert wants to see a feasibility study where they can't lay back further to the south onto the B2 Gold Orion joint venture. So they're asking, whoever they are, the suitors, which I would think would be Agnico and potentially B2 Gold, because even if they sell their part of the joint venture, if Rupert or somebody can consolidate that area, they will definitely be a takeout target. The game is definitely afoot in that area of Finland. And for me, that's an exciting, probably, it's about, I think it was 60 days from the initial announcement that something's going to give. And so that's an exciting one to watch.
So, Joe, with so many companies active here and consolidation needed, but some clear suitors that could do that consolidating, as an investor, how would you invest in this area if you wanted to put some money at work?
Well, I already have. I'm in Orion Resources. They're the cog in that entire agreement to consolidate. And if it was a weaker player or in weaker hands, that right of first refusal, I might have sold it earlier, but because the chairman is David Lotan, I just spoke to him in Zurich when I was at the Swiss Mining Institute. I've got all the confidence in the world that he'll do the best thing for shareholders there, as he is himself one of the bigger shareholders of the company.
So, Joe, one more company that I want to get your quick insights on that has a strategic investment that actually has just made a new discovery that really got moving this week in the market was Awale Resources in Cote d'Ivoire. I've had them on the show a number of times earlier. We've seen a management change. We've seen almost a renewed effort in terms of exploration and a new discovery that the market took note of, that Charger discovery. What's your takeaway from this, at least initial discovery?
Well, I mean, kudos to the management team, the exploration team. They've done an excellent job. I owned that one a while ago, back in 21, and this was a really, a decent 6 cent private placement. It's, I think it hit a buck yesterday, but I sold it probably because of, well, for sure, because of all the reasons you just mentioned. There were management issues, and my focus at that time was more on the Empire prospect, which was just to the south, and that hit some 100 gram meter intersections as well, but the continuity wasn't there, and they weren't able to reproduce it. And since they've gone through a few other prospects, and I think that the Newmont joint venture, although it looks now very inexpensive, $15 million to get 65% of that land package, it looks cheap. But at that time, where they were getting no fundamental support from the markets, it looked good. 12 cents, equity, private placements, the joint venture. So they knew that they had money to continue, and they were able to drill these sort of holes. Because if you look at the cross section, there's two holes that they drilled. There were scissors, looked like scissors on the cross section, and they didn't hit much. But they drilled a hole underneath that was at a different orientation, according to Andrew Chubb, who's now the CEO and formerly the VPX, because they thought, this other orientation of structure might have been better. And with that, they hit this whopping hole. In this intrusion that's brecciated, where they get the breccia and they get the really good silicification is where they start getting these 200 plus gram per ton intersections over a meter. So yeah, very impressive. Looks cylindrical and it's very structurally controlled. So kudos to Andrew. That was a very good bit of exploration.
Well, and Joe, this brings up one of the areas of the resource space that gets exciting for investors, and that's the potential of M&A and the potential of takeovers and the good old-fashioned bidding wars. And we did just see a bidding war with Osino, where Dundee Precious Metals came in to make an offer, and then a Chinese consortium ended up buying the project out. It was actually a win for shareholders. Instead of a take-under, we actually had a legit takeover. And then we're seeing a move by Alamos Gold to move on Argonaut. So this brings in the larger discussion of M&A in the sector. I'd love to get your thoughts on how you see things shaping up.
Oh, absolutely. I think M&A in the gold sector is, obviously a good sign that companies want to make their acquisitions happen before they think the valuations are going to get higher. So M&A is always a good sign that the market's about to turn. And with respect to Osino in Namibia, a multiple bid, increasing offers and converting to all cash. So I think Dundee, which had a large working capital position, was going to offer 50% cash, which was also a nice offer and also at a decent premium. But then Yintai came over them. The only risk there is the Canadian government. And if they sort of put the kibosh in it because it's a Chinese acquirer, let's see what happens there. But otherwise, yeah, that's definitely a good sign with respect to the gold sector.
What else are you watching for in terms of M&A? Because even with this M&A, we always hear some of the naysayers saying it was a take under. I'm with you, Joe. I think all M&A is good. It frees up capital. Unfortunately, it can lock in losses for some investors, but that's just what happens sometimes in this sector. What else are you looking for on the M&A front that could cause some excitement or at least free up some capital for investors?
Okay. I mean, if we just go back to what I just said about, where the market is and, multiple bids, higher premiums. So just last year, probably a lot of people were complaining about the B2 Gold, acquisition of Sabina, and they called that a take under. But it freed up capital and got people away out of Sabina because they knew the big capital was coming and, then they would have to come to the markets to raise it. So we've definitely had a change. If we go a little bit deeper into the Alamos Argonaut thing, Argonaut bought Prodigy Gold for the Magino deposit. I visited that project, and their deeper drilling did show signs that they had the same high-grade mineralization that was what Richmont had. Richmont is what Alamos bought. I think that acquisition is predominantly about looking for extensions to the island mine, because that's where Alamos has been making more of their money. So that one makes a lot of sense to acquire. As we see a lot of M&A now that makes a lot of sense, prudent, and the investors are getting paid, I think that's a very good sign for the entire gold sector. Going forward, besides Orion that we just talked about, the other one that I would look forward to for a potential M&A is Origin Royalties, which for their 1% NSR on that large, 10 to 14 million ounce silicon deposit that AngloGold Ashanti is advancing in Nevada.
Well, Joe, it's interesting you bring that one up. We actually just had Origin on the show not too long ago. We were talking about just how significant that cornerstone asset is. But in the royalty space, compared to most of the precious metal sector, we actually did see a couple of years ago a lot of M&A activity. We saw LA Gold taken out and Abitibi Royalties and Golden Valley. We saw a hostile bid almost on Elemental, but then they merged with Altus. You had Mavericks and Nomad scooped up by Triple Flag and Sandstorm, respectively. When that happens in the royalty space, when a junior royalty company is acquired by a larger company, do you like that as an investor? Because it usually goes into a more solid company, but it's a slower moving company with less torque.
From the perspective of an investor, if somebody is offering you cash, I think your only risk is if they are raising the cash from debt. Otherwise, if they have the working capital and it's all cash, you probably care probably less about the company that's acquiring. If it's like 50% shares or 100% shares, like a lot of these royalty deals are, you do care about the acquirer. You care about potentially the leverage within the acquirer of the asset that you may still like. So if we take Origin, that 1% on a potential tier one asset, if you want to keep holding on to that new company, because we've seen this before where tier one assets don't get acquired once, they get acquired multiple times. And like Fosterville, I mean, Crocodile Gold, Newmarket, Kirkland, Agnico, same asset, being bought for a higher and higher valuation as it progresses. So that potentially could happen. And for that kind of exposure, and if you want to hold on to it, you would be more concerned about the acquirer.
Joe, what about the acquisitions or potential acquisitions of what we have seen, these development stories where it seems like companies might be running out of money or at least having trouble getting it past the finish line, and another company does need to step in? Usually they have cash flow of some sort, but they also need to raise money on the back of it. I know it's individual case-by-case basis, but what have you seen when we have seen these type of acquisitions happen and the time frame afterwards?
Well, I mean, I think right now the most undervalued sector, I'm sorry, or stage, let's say, of the gold sector, and also probably in all the sectors, is the development stories, because of the paucity of retail, and probably more problematic, the paucity of institutional equity. There's not a lot of support for development stories. So there's unique stories like G Mining Ventures, which is building the Tocantinzinho gold project in Brazil, that have a lot of support. But I mean, they've got the Lundin Group, they've got, I believe, Pierre Lassonde, they've got a whole bunch of notables that are helping them with funding. But there's very few development stories out there that have that kind of multiple support networks, which is exactly what you need. So for a company that does not have a pipeline that's looking for the next development project, this is an ideal situation to look at whatever development story is out there and acquire it probably at a discount, as long as you can bring hopefully a better way of developing it, some synergies with your own project Which is probably similar to what Alamos is doing with Argonaut. There's synergies there, potentially with the Island Mine and Magino, and potentially what's underground underneath Magino. So as long as you could bring that to the party, this is a perfect environment for those people that want to step into that stage.
Well, Joe, just to that point, for people looking at the developers in the gold and silver space or even in the copper space, whenever there's a big M&A deal, people get very excited. But the truth is, most of the projects sit on the rack year after year, cycle after cycle. There's some projects in the gold space that have been there for two or three cycles already and have never gotten bought out. How do you separate the projects you actually think are going to get taken over from the ones that are not going to build the mine, but they're just sitting there waiting with their hat out, hoping that they get taken over?
Due diligence. You got to go look at the asset, look at how good it is or bad it is, and see if it's going to work. And so those are the ones that in the letter we don't buy, because there's no ultimate game there. You know, problematically, you know, they could still go up in share price in the interim, but there may not be a suitor at the end of the day. And that's the kind of stuff we do here at Exploration Insights. So we try to look for that fatal flaw early. And but the problem is that, you know, I don't buy knowing that there's a fatal flaw, thinking that somebody else will buy it in terms and the share price will go up. I don't tend to do that. I just won't touch that one. And so, I mean, that's exactly what we try to do in the letter. And that takes work. That takes site visits. That takes reading through the technical reports and all that sort of stuff to know, you know, which project will work and which won't.
Joe, give us a breakdown on the investment landscape that you see then for this sector, because broadly, the stocks have rebounded. A lot of upside still to go in a lot of these equities, but it does seem like the majors are starting to lead the way a little bit. Even this week, we saw a bit more action in some of the ETFs. There's been a general uptick in some interest in the equities, but again, it's still lagging a lot of other sectors and still lagging the gold price. So what's your assessment of the overall investing landscape right now for the mid-tiers and the juniors?
Well, I think the gold price is there. There's no debate about where the gold price is and where it's going. The problem is the cost structure for the producers is increasing probably at a higher pace, compressing people's margins. And it's those people that can control their costs are the ones that are going to win in this current environment. And it's those people that have a comparative advantage, you know, that they have infrastructure and they can acquire these assets at a fraction of the price, but also they can cut the capital costs because they're already in the area. You know, those are the sort of synergistic M&A the environment is ripe for that kind, because the gold price is there, but the valuation isn't there for the potential M&A targets.
All right, Joe, we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on a wide variety of kind of investment angles for exploration equities and even some of the mid-tiers. I really do appreciate all of your insights through Exploration Insights. I recommend everybody checking out that newsletter if you already don't know about Joe and what he does in terms of the due diligence and market research into all of these companies. Joe, we'll chat again next month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thank you very much, Corey and Chad. We'll see you guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.